This episode discusses details of sex and sexuality, and it is intended for a mature audience.
Welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson. And tonight I'm here with my trusted partner in crime, Zilpha. Hi, Zilpha.
Hey, John. Hey, everybody.
And we are alone tonight in the studio in the Den of Iniquity.
All alone.
We're going to try something. And it may or may not work. And if it doesn't work, you'll probably never hear this.
Let's talk about sex, baby.
So for this year, 2012, we've sort of set up a goal of starting to work through some of the things that, as members of the church, we don't understand or we don't know about. During this holiday season, we went to a family party, and I won't say much more about it than that, but we were sitting around with a bunch of adults. And these were all our peers, people around about our same age. There was no like grandparents or anybody there. And some of the other people at the party, they were all faithful members of the church, started playing some games. And I noticed something, that these were all like children's games, like games that little kids would play at parties. And then I started thinking about conversation that people were having. And
what do you mean little kids games?
We were playing little kids games.
Like what?
Like stringing things on the stick.
Oh, well, that's Minute to Win It.
Whatever it was. But there was nothing adult about any of their interaction. And I started thinking about most of our interaction with a lot of LDS people. And yeah, they do their parties and they talk to each other like 9-year-olds. I think there's a good reason for this. I think the church tends to, for cultural and doctrinal and institutional reasons that are probably beyond the scope of this podcast, tend to keep the members in a perpetual juvenile state. And what that means for people who are transitioning out of that traditional faith role model or have left the church, they're oftentimes in a juvenile state and they don't understand the way the world works. So, for example, most Mormons just do not understand alcohol at all. They don't understand what it's like to be intoxicated or have a couple drinks. They don't understand anything about it. So we have on the schedule a future podcast to help people understand alcohol. And it's not to get people to drink or anything. It's to help people understand that.
Bring them out of the naivety.
That being said, one of the things that, as Zilph and I are fortunate that we get to meet a lot of people who listen to the podcast, and one of the things that people talk about and they very much appreciate is that we have frankly and openly talked about sex in the past. And because a lot of people in the church don't know anything about it. A close person to us, who's still in the church, admitted to Zilpha just a year or two ago that when she got married, she didn't even know what a clitoris was.
Well, I barely did. You told me about that.
Yeah, I did. So, the rest of this discussion is going to be a frank discussion about sex, especially aimed at those who may or may not know about it. So if you're offended by such things, I advise you to turn off now.
No, actually, leave it on, because you're probably the one who needs to hear it the most.
If you are offended by such things, you probably should listen to the rest of this, but I'm not gonna force that on you, because we believe that sex should be openly discussed with children and with each other and like you would anything else. Sex is an important component of our psyche and probably part of the oldest parts of our brain. You know, our desire for safety and our desire to or our basic want for fight or flight and for food and for sex. These are all primal things. And I believe that when those things are repressed or stifled, they tend to come out in negative ways.
When he says talk openly about sex to children, he means appropriate openness.
Well, of course, yeah, in an age-appropriate way. But I think we're all children, so we're going to talk about sex for the next hour or so. And we'll see how this goes.
That's right.
All right. So just for those who may be new to the podcast, we've been married about 15 and a half years at this point. So we've been together.
Yep. I got married. When we got married, I was 19. John was 23.
That's right. All right.
And we were virgins.
When we got married, so we got married in 1996. And I started at BYU in 1991. And at that time, there were still two competing vibes at BYU. And these were real and active. I mean, you heard about these in, say, the religion classes. People talked about them, which is a really conservative, traditional sexual outlook, which was personified or marked by two particular elements. Do not practice birth control and do not practice oral sex.
Was basically sex for procreation.
Sex for, well, I think at that time there still a strong sex for recreation.
Well, it was a bonding thing.
No, there was, let me take that back. No sex for recreation, but there was sex for expression of love in a marriage.
For bonding and for like feeling the spirit.
So there are fundamentalists out there in the United States who believe strongly in a sex for procreation only, and it's sort of a Catholic tenet. But that is not Mormonism. Mormonism doesn't seem to have ever had a problem with the fact that sex is enjoyable.
Most of the time, that is true. I think you could find a couple of quotes from a few stray dogs saying it's only for procreation. But overall, Mormons the Mormon leadership has taught its members that sex is for bonding and expression of love, but mostly for procreation.
Yeah, and the church had a very strong anti birth control stand up through the 60s and 70s, and then it's kind of pittered out. They'll say into the 80s, 90s, and today they'll say, have as many children as you're psychologically capable of having, or some caveat like that. But they've never retracted those other speeches.
Even that conference in the fall or was it spring? Recent conference, they said, you know, that you should have children, even if you're not done with school, and that if you don't have children, then you're not really having faith in God that He's going to help you through that.
Yeah, and this issue sort of underlines a rhetorical problem the church has always had, which is lowest man wins, or the guy with the strongest feelings on a topic is going to express them. So let's say you're in the 12 and you feel strongly that oral sex is not only okay, but it's really good and people should do it. You're probably not going to say that in conference, but if you're a member of the 12 who feels very strongly against things like oral sex, you're not going to come out and say oral sex, but you're going to couch it in other terms, and you're going to control the discourse. And this happens not only in sex, but in a lot of elements of the church, where if you look, there'll be these few people. So in the last 50 years, you have Spencer Kimball, Boyd Packer, and
wasn't Holland saying?
Well, there's been a little bit, and who's the other? Who's that other nut job? Marky Peterson.
Oh my gosh!
And these three—he's
out of the universe.
When you read a lot of their books, and fortunately for like Peterson, well, for all of them, they've written a lot of stuff. And somebody out there, there's a master's degree out there to go and psychologically analyze these guys' attitude about sex. It's quite warped. And there's quite a few things in there that are flat out wrong. You know, that masturbation causes homosexuality, or masturbation leads to bestiality,
or pedophilia,
and these things are in their books. So, but what my point is they tend to control the discourse because they get up and say birth control is wickedness. And then no one else comes in and says, hey, wait a minute. My wife and I have been practicing birth control for 20 years and we're in the Quorum of the 12. So suck on that. But so what you get in the church is the dominating voice. But I'm not trying to excuse the church, because the church owns this. I mean, the brethren have set this policy up where they're all prophets, seers, and revelators. So I will say the doctrine is established when a member of the Quorum of the 12 or multiple members of the Quorum of the 12 say something and no one else contradicts it. The only time you have doctrinal controversy, if there is a counterpoint, and I would say with something like birth control, there's never been a counterpoint.
So this was the first outlook. You were talking about there were two main outlooks.
Oh,
about the time we got married.
I said there were two main issues: birth control and oral sex.
Oh, I thought you were saying there were two kind of.
Oh, two camps.
Yeah.
So the one camp was the very hard line, you know, no birth control, no sodomy. And you know, and I'll use the legal definition of sodomy, which is anything besides straight intercourse, and then there's the other camp, which was what you and your legally, lawfully sealed spouse do in the privacy of your own room, as long as everybody's on board, is fine. And there's still tension between those two camps. You will still see those things come up, that's the prevalent sexual attitude in the church today. But I just wanted to set that when we first got married, our bishop advised us to, you know, delay having kids, that we had plenty of time, and our doctor did too. You know, we went to the first doctor, and we went to
the doctor at the BYU Health Center.
And you know, he sat down and said, "This is how many years you have in your your reproductive life, and there's no hurry, and all
he
that."
He encouraged
sort of stuff.
Didn't encourage me, but he certainly didn't discourage me, and he told me that it was fine to be on birth control. You know, like, I was concerned about health effects or psychological effects of birth control. He said, you should be fine.
Right. I have a vague memory. I could go back and find the research, but I'm not going to, that at the time that we were at BYU in the mid-90s, there was research about the welfare usage among students, and it was rather high. And there was some concern in some quarters about that a lot of BYU students were going on public assistance and church assistance. And it was mainly because they were students who were having children.
They were both students.
Right,
they'd
right.
take their babies to class.
And yes. So that kind of gives the milieu of where we came from. But I think for the foundation of this discussion, it should be clear, like other conservative Americans, this is a problem all over America. Americans are just backwards when it comes to sexuality. And we were watching a documentary just a couple, which documentary was that? They went around to teens, these are late teens, like 16, 17, in the United States, and asked them, do you have a condom? And the teens in the United States said, ew, that's gross.
They said, what if a partner, you know, your boyfriend or your girlfriend, you were aware that they carried a condom with them.
Right.
And they said, oh, well, then I think they were just trying to get some, and, you know, that they were.
Yeah, I wouldn't date him.
Yeah.
Or her.
That they're just loose. Well,
and they gave a more drastic response when the question was, what if a girl was carrying a condom? Oh, she's a slut. You know, but then they asked the same question to European youths, and they're like,
we wouldn't date someone who didn't carry a condom around.
Yeah, they all pulled out their condoms that they were carrying.
Yeah.
But you know, I don't think that, and I don't have statistics in front of me here, but European youth are that much more or any different in their sexual activity than American youth.
Well, they get less pregnancies, teen pregnancies.
But, you know, statistics have shown over and over again that the less sex ed, the less access to birth control, you know, all these things don't negatively affect the rate of sexual activity.
Right.
Meaning, like, evangelical kids are just as likely, if not more likely, to engage in sexual activity, engage in risky sexual activity.
They're like more likely to engage in risky sexual behaviors.
So So, but the environment the church is in, and where the church controls, and if we take like parts of Idaho, Utah, parts of Nevada, the church and its church leadership really control the political situation. And sex ed, it's not as extreme as, say, Southern evangelicals, but it is pretty extreme. It's not merely abstinence-only education in Utah, but there is very, very little information.
Well, I think the fear is that they don't want to give teenagers ideas that, right. that you know, they think that if we don't tell them all the details and how things work and how things feel and what goes where and how and what does what, then maybe they won't figure it out and then they'll be safe.
Right. So the typical, the pattern, and of course there's plenty of people who become sexually active young, but the pattern in the church is you are to do no dating until you're 16. And then from 16 to mission time, you are to date in groups.
You're not supposed to get very close to one person of the opposite sex.
And any activity in which the sexes meet with the church are highly chaperoned and highly supervised. And that doesn't mean kids can't slip off into the broom closet, but if you're following the pattern, which a lot of the youth do, you know, I think sometimes we tend to focus in on the exceptions to that. And there are lots of kids who get sexually active, but even then they're not necessarily learning a lot. It's like they're having good sex when they're 16 in the broom closet. So what I'm saying is there is for members of the church who are playing by the rules, there is precious little time to learn, good information about sex.
And even about being intimate with someone of the opposite sex, or you know, with someone that you're sexually attracted to, you're not encouraged to form any kind of intimate relationship until it's time to get married, and then it's kind of a scramble to find somebody quick
and
get that done.
It is hard on both sides. We've had the Zilf and I will talk openly about sex among our friends and whatever, and we think it's healthy. So we've heard lots of different stories. And on both sides where that it's bad, you're dirty, it's dirty, sex is nasty, and then suddenly it's okay, messes with people's head, both men and women. I've met men who couldn't achieve an erection on their wedding night. I've met several of those. I've met the girls who were just mortified and petrified and hidden because they had no idea, just the natural progression of moving from just on physical activity, physical love.
Well, and if you've never seen, a picture of a real penis, you know, usually they have those line drawings, which look very little like a real penis. When you see a real
penis, they're always cutaway.
Yeah, cutaway, it's like oh,
half a
that?
Person.
It's just a totally different animal, and I do mean animal.
We'll get into that a little bit further down.
But
here.
I'm saying it can be extremely intimidating to a female when all of a sudden you realize, you know, what it is that's going to be going into you.
And it can be intimidating for years. It's not uncommon for people to, even though they have sex, they're always in the missionary position. They don't look.
They turn out the lights.
They turn out the lights. So they're still not very familiar with either their own anatomy or the anatomy of their partner.
And either they're afraid of, I've heard from not a lot of women, but several women who have such a fear of their own body. Like they are uncomfortable with their body in such a way that even their spouse can't see it nude.
Yes. Yeah. And you know, there's people who, I think these are rarities, but there are people who will only have sex with their underwear on, with their garments on.
Luckily, I've never heard an actual story about that.
No, that's where I was saying before. I think we are progressing on as a people and a culture, and we're moving forward sexually. But I think we have a long ways to go, especially when it comes to communication. All right. So we've laid the foundation that a lot of Mormons are very naive about sex, and they carry that naivete with them well into their marriages. I think Americans in general, but Mormons in particular, still have a hard time talking about sex. And you need to with your spouse. You need to talk about sex both when you've got a boner and when you don't have a boner. So you need to talk about sex in both aspects. And I think a lot of couples don't do that, you know. And we'll get into that a little bit more. But so let's first of all talk about sort of the evolution of human sexuality. I think one thing that everybody needs to understand is sex is the oldest part of our brains, of our...
Probably equal with a need to get food.
Well, I would think you can go back to amoebas that were absorbing, you know, at some point way billions of years back in the evolution, things started sexually reproducing. Long
yeah,
before
but they had
any,
to
anything that we would
consume some sort of
they would absorb something from their environment or whatever. But you're right, these are old instincts. And the instinct from the organism point of view has to be so strong that it prevents the species from dying out. So I think that's an important thing in Mormonism, because you read a lot of the talks on sexuality, and they seem to cover this theme of controlling or completely mastering your sexuality. Your sexuality goes beyond thought. I mean, it is subordinate to thought. And the idea that, you know, the example that Boyd Packer brought up years ago of the stage, and that you could control what's on the stage and usher it off, it's utter nonsense.
Think about that. I don't know if they still do it, but they used to have a missionary discussion where they'd put the hand in the glove, the hand being the spirit, the glove being this just floppy body. So, like, the spirit is supposed to be in complete control of the body. But when you look at it from an evolutionary perspective, that's just utter nonsense, because there's so much that we carry with us from our past evolutionarily.
Well, and chemicals, and we learn so much about, even if you, I don't want to get into the discussion of whether or not there's a soul, but there is so much that's physical.
If there is a soul, it doesn't seem to be able to do much for us. You get a brain injury and apparently the person's gone, you know, like.
If you are a mentally challenged male sexual predator, they will give you Depo-Provera shots, which will kill your sex drive. It's sort of a chemical castration thing. Zilf and I are watching a documentary about a year ago, a fascinating one. I should probably look up the title for y'all. And it investigated transgendered people who are transitioning from male to female and female to male. And of course, part of that is they go on hormone therapy. Both do. They'll either start taking estrogen or they'll start taking testosterone. So they investigated, they talked to these people because they had sort of experienced living as a chemical female and as a chemical male. And they compare the difference. And I remember one that was it was a woman who was transitioning. And oftentimes when you transition, you keep your sexual orientation. So when she was a woman, she was a lesbian, and then she transitioned to a man and she still liked women. You don't usually switch that. But she talks about how before she was on testosterone, she would look at a woman and say, "Oh, that woman's beautiful." And then after she got on testosterone, she talked about how it became so, it was just a gut reaction that she wanted the woman, how guttural her sexual reaction to the object of her desire became. And it was simply a matter of that chemical. It was nothing that was her thought process or her free will or anything like that. It was there's these processes that are going on inside us that are very, very deep. And I think the more we can understand those, first of all, the more we can be forgiving to human behavior, and the more we can understand our own behavior, which is important in a relationship, because you sort of need to understand the desires and behavior of your spouse.
Right. And the thoughts, I mean, and why men say enjoy looking at pornography. Women do too, but it's typically associated with men. We can talk about that.
Okay.
I mean, that's kind of the same thing with the testosterone that woman got. Just by seeing a woman, it gave the new man the urge.
Right.
So some people theorize that men are more visually stimulated than women are.
Yeah, I think there's pretty good evidence for that. And, you know, if you look back from the what's going to those who pass their genes on to the next generation are those who successfully reproduce. So from a genetic evolutionary perspective, it is the single most important thing. Everything else becomes subordinate to that. The only purpose to feed yourself is so that you can reproduce. Because if you don't reproduce, you're a genetic dead end, and you don't pass any of your traits on to the next generation.
Right. And which are the people who are most likely to pass on their genes? The ones who are sexually active.
The ones who are sexually active and who can produce viable offspring. So there are elements. So what I'm saying is the higher thought that Boyd Packer and those guys are talking about came secondary and is subordinate to the sex systems that are working in the body. Because if our species in fact evolved such that our rational minds could completely control our sexuality, we would have probably died out thousands of years ago. But that you just can't stop those things. I mean,
and that's important.
Literally, they can't be stopped because of that's the way we're wired. Now, individually you can, but we're talking about on sort of a bell curve, you know.
You think individually people can...
There are some individuals, you know.
Some individuals. But it usually seems to turn out that they've been, you know, thinking around secretly.
Well, I mean, that happens all the time. You get these people...
I think there's very few who actually go through their lives without any kind of sexual interaction of any kind.
Yeah, and but we do know there's asexuals. They have no sexual desire. Now, what's ironic is I can't remember. I should have looked these things up. But a large portion, like 40% or something like that, of asexuals masturbate. So they have no sexual desire. They have no sexual.
Maybe they're just not attracted to other people.
Well, yeah, I remember hearing an interview with one in particular. He was the head of the Asexuals of America or whatever, and he admitted to masturbation. He says it's sort of like maintenance. It's just something you do to maintain your body, but he doesn't have sexual desire for either his own gender or the other gender, uh-huh. And most asexuals don't mate. So if you think about a scale of sexuality, I mean, just like any sort of trait like strength, or speed, or whatever, there's going to be a diversification of sexuality, of sexual desire. There's going to be a certain percentage of the population that has a very strong sexual desire, and a certain percent that has a very weak sexual desire.
So should the weak ones be judging the...
Well, that's the problem in the church.
The strong ones.
Is the church has a flaw in terms of human sexuality, which is those who have a weak sexual drive...
Do well.
Can rise to the top because they're more likely. So, for example, if a mission president selects his APs or his zone leaders from the missionaries who do not confess to masturbation, and let's eliminate the liars. But my point is that those guys can systematically rise through the ranks where a bishop who struggles himself with, say, masturbation might be less of a strong leader as far as the church is concerned because he's more...
Kind of beats himself up all the time.
I wasn't even going to go there. He's more retrospect. He's not as... Sometimes the guys with the heavy-duty rhetoric are the ones who rise... I mean, look at the presidential candidates. It's oftentimes these extremists who get up there because a good centrist does not sound good stumping in Iowa. You know, they're like, yeah, well, it could go either way. Or, you know, everything's complicated. And, you know, it's like, I want to eliminate the Department of Education. Those are the guys who sort of become the rhetorical leaders. And that happens a lot in the church. That you get your Boyd Packers and your Bruce McConkies because they're entertaining to listen to. And a good centrist like Hubie Brown just gets washed out. And people don't even remember them because they everything's nuanced. Hmm. So... All right.
Well, wasn't Jesus nuanced?
Well, that's a whole other thing. All right. So let's talk about the standard model. Among sexual evolutionary biologists, there's what's called the standard model of sexuality, which is sort of a play on game theory, which is a woman from the time she delivers her offspring to about 6 or 7 years later. Is biologically more vulnerable. You know, she needs to, and we really need to go back in time. You got to think back 15, 20,000 years ago. So she needs somebody to provide for her. Somebody
while she's taking care of the... It's probably at least 4 years.
Or somebody's. Yeah, until the children in tribal situations sort of separate from their parents around 6, 7, 8 years old, and they'll start living in the common house and stuff like that. But they're really attached to their mothers before
that.
Yeah,
when they're young and need constant care, then the woman would have needed someone... Mm-hmm. To provide the meat.
So in the standard model that that the female, and you have to remember when we talk about males and females doing things, this is genetics. This is not like conscious behavior, not like wicked women or evil men doing things. So the female needed to entice the male to stick around and protect the young, which is fairly uncommon in nature. I mean, it happens to some degree or the other.
You mean with other animals?
Yeah. So for example, we are one of the few species, one of the few mammals that doesn't go into heat. When the female is in heat, she produces pheromones or other signaling device to say that she is fertile.
We almost have the opposite, a whole week of ick to say.
But in the standard model, they would say this is one of the reproductive strategies that we could mate. And I read, I think in, it wasn't in Bonk, it was in Sex at Dawn, and they actually broke down the number of copulation species have per birth, and humans are just way off the chart. There is no animal, even bonobos, aren't even close to us. We are the most sexually active by a long shot.
Per birth.
And what's interesting is that pair bonding animals that pair bond, are the lowest. So if you...
Weird.
So animals that pair bond tend to have intercourse very, very rarely, and they do it just for reproduction. But in the standard narrative, we sort of develop this hypersexuality as a strategy, as a mating strategy, a protection strategy, so that the males would stick around and sort of bond with a particular female and stay with her. Now, if that model is true, they would argue that the model only needed to hold for 6 or 7 or 8 years, because then it would be a more reasonable reproductive strategy for the female to find another male. So if you're
mix
trying
it
to
up
get,
a little bit,
if you're talking about the probability of your offspring surviving, you would rather have 6 children from 6 different fathers than 6 children from the same father, because whatever genetic defect he has is going to be passed on. And just statistically speaking, you're going to pass your genes, the female, on to more males. So the standard theory has the pair bonding and cheat model, which is that the male and the female will basically pair bond, but they will seek for opportunities to
spread their seed afar.
Right. And there's a lot of research out there. There's a lot of fascinating things been written about all this, but a lot of people in the animal kingdom do it too. I think
a lot of people in the
animal? A lot of animals. I think it was something like ducks or birds or some bird where they said these stay together. Maybe they're swans, I don't know. These got pair bonds. So the scientists went and took the eggs and did genetic sampling. They determined that a whole 1/3 of all the ones in their sample group, it wasn't the pair bonded male that had fertilized that particular egg. So the scientists would argue that pair bonding in this standard model is in our genetic makeup. It's something we want to do, but cheating is also, and seeking sexual variety and seeking multiple partners and wanting to, and being sexually stimulated by others outside your spouse are there. Now there's other models that argue that it's much more complex, and if you look at other societies like matriarchies or other things around the world that are viable today, people talk about patriarchy and pair bonding like it's universal. It isn't, and there are plenty of tribes that are scattered around the world that don't follow those models at all. Successfully, they don't follow those models.
Mm-hmm.
So that there.
Yeah, I watched a documentary about a place in, I think it was Tibet, where it was a matriarchy, and the female would have like 3 male partners. So it's sort of like polyandry. So she would live with one of her parents, and then she would have these guys that would just rotate in and out of the house.
Well, I remember from my anthropology classes that the usually there is a household, and a household always is made up of males and females. But those males and females don't always mate. Like in our society, the household is
the constructed of
a mating pair. And there's problems with that because once they no longer have that attraction, it breaks up the household. Where in matriarchies and other societies, it tends to be the females live with their brothers.
Yes, that's what it was. She lived with her brothers. Right, and then she'd have these guys that would come in and out. And so her brothers were sort of the fathers to her children.
Right, they raised the children in the household.
Yeah.
And then there's others, like I mentioned earlier, sort of longhouse models where the women live together, the men live together, and the children are raised more in a communal sort of setting. So those who tell you that patriarchy is like the only model, it's not true.
Well, and then you have the other complication of pair bonding that's a more recent complication, and that is that we're living a heck of a lot longer than we ever did before. And so, you know, where before a pair would maybe be, you know, 15, 20 years together, now it can be 80 years together. And that's a huge difference.
Right. Yeah. And what we're basically saying is that genetically, we're not necessarily set up. You have strong inclination for novelty in sexual relationships.
Well, just like in food. I mean, right.
Let's table that discussion. I think that's important. And I would suggest everybody go out and read up more on this. I was making my mental list of books that everybody should read. And I'll give these I'll give them now before I forget. Well, no, I'll give them at the end. let me make a note.
Making note now.
So let's talk a little bit about anatomy. We did lay the foundation that humans are biologically programmed to enjoy sex. I'm going to refer to this book several times, but I think the book is Sex at Dawn. If you take the average human copulation time span, they put it at,
like how long they're actually physically copulating.
So from the time the penis enters the vagina till the male orgasms is somewhere around 2 to 3 minutes. This is on average. The next, like of our primates down, it's like 9 seconds. Like chimps and bonobos and gorillas, they all orgasm very, very quickly.
So you're saying that female humans who complain about the shortness of they've actually got it pretty good?
Well, what I'm saying is, obviously a lot of people have sex longer than two minutes, but the sex act is physiologically designed to be an enjoyable recreational thing that people do. People do it because they like it, and they're driven to do it because they like it. As human beings, we enjoy sex.
And female humans are lucky as far as organisms go, because there might be a few other animals whose females can orgasm.
Yeah, I remember reading something about the bonobos or whatever, but yeah.
It's very, very, very rare. And if you've ever seen cats going at it, their females just don't have a good time at all.
Right. I mean, there's obviously a drive there, but whether or not they find the act physically enjoyable,
it doesn't
seem like it. So we're very fortunate there. I think we talked in the previous podcast a little bit about sexual dimorphism, that men and women physically look different, and those differences tend to be sexualized differently in different societies, and they tend to be emphasized. So, for example, I think we talked about this in the previous podcast. Women's feet are smaller than men's feet because women tend to be smaller. So the Chinese got a tradition of foot binding to make them even smaller to emphasize the difference between, you know, that particular female feature and that particular male feature. But really the only feature that is like 100% programmed, other than I think we are, in my opinion, we are programmed to sort of notice the differences and to notice signs of health, vigor, virility, and competence, because it is absolutely clear from anthropological studies that our sexuality is not merely physical, that we have reserved part of our brains, or part of our brains have held in reserve to be able to identify cultural cues that signal the ability to successfully care for the individual and the offspring. So this is the old cliche where you'll see men, old men, attracted to young females, and for signs of virility, like wider hips and larger breasts and youthful skin and complexion.
Blonder hair.
But blonde hair, look at traditional blonde. Blonde hair is a juvenile trait that most people lose by the time they get to be an adult. So it's a signal that somebody's young. And females are physically attracted to males, obviously, but also tend to get signaled on signs of wealth and power. Who is it? Said that power is the ultimate aphrodisiac
for women.
I think it was Henry Kissinger. But you see that all the time. These young women with these hideous old billionaires, you know, and people say, oh, she's just a girl. I have no doubt she is attracted to him because mm-hmm. I think that's part. And I'm not trying to throw either. These things just are. They're neither good nor bad. But they are there.
Well, if you're his ex-wife, closer to his age, it's probably a bad thing.
So, you know, if you take something like breast size, it's not 100% correlation, but there is a correlation between the size of the breast and the ability to breastfeed a baby to provide them enough nutrition. And traditionally, once again, we have to talk about 20,000 years ago.
Are you sure there's a correlation between breast size and how much you can put out? Breast milk? I've just never heard that. Are you you gonna look it up? Because I thought that the breasts were attractive to males because they resemble a butt.
Well, that is a theory. Well, while I'm looking at this, why don't you explain that?
Well, because, you know, in our past, copulation was done from behind, so a male would mount a female. And so they would have to want to be, you know, close to the buttocks. And I guess if you had a nice round bottom, that you were a healthy female.
Well, I guess I'm wrong. According to Google, and the internet doesn't lie, there's no correlation. But
yeah, I wouldn't think so. I think it's just more of like just showing that you have some substance and some, you know, that your baby's not going to starve to death.
So this book is a little bit dated, but the book is called The Naked Ape.
When it's growing in you.
Desmond Morris wrote this book in the late 70s, and he makes a strong, strong case, I think, that is still held common as to why breasts are shaped the way they are. Not only are human breasts larger than other primates, they are shaped completely differently. And like Zilf was saying, they're rounded to, and a lot of people theorize that it's to move the men around from the back, which is the mating strategy for most animals, to the front, where there's face-to-face contact
and can
facilitate pair bonding. So breasts themselves are not necessarily an object of innate sexual desire. I mean, some men like them large, some men like them small.
And if you live in a society where they're constantly exposed, it's not as sexual of an item.
Right. Any more than any other sort of sexual dimorphism is. I think that if you were to go in a society where women walk around without any shirts on, the men would find it attractive. But
just
men,
like we find men's calves attractive,
right,
or whatever.
Or men find women's lips very attractive. And there's very few societies that cover them up. There are women. There are societies that do cover them up. But I think it would be on par with that.
Yeah.
You know, and if you look at, like, you know, the anatomy of a male nipple versus the anatomy of a female nipple, there's nothing really different about
than
order of size.
Yeah, if you've seen females with very small breasts, it basically looks like a man's chest.
Right, right. So, well, my point is that no one thinks twice about that. And you watch these shows like The Biggest Loser, and these guys are going on there without the shirts on with double Ds floating around in, like, the big fat guys.
Oh.
You know? And they, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway. But let's talk about the vagina.
We do definitely sexualize the breasts.
We do. But different societies, my point, I keep going, it sexualize different parts of the body, and they'll move around covering up the...
It's not necessarily a bad thing unless you're trying to breastfeed.
There are erogenous zones, which are more sensitive areas of the body. But, you know, one of the big ones is the neck and shoulder, like over the clavicle.
Yeah.
And some societies cover that up. And some societies do not.
Oh, that's such a good spot.
So there is no You know, like our society in the United States is very open about kissing. And kissing is a very intimate activity, and one that in other societies, they would no sooner be caught in public kissing mouth to mouth than they would having intercourse, because it's a very, very intimate thing. And it's just a matter of
culture
that's allowed or that's not. So
it still feels good to them. It's just a different way of looking at it.
There's not a lot of confusion about the upper half of a woman's body. Some people enjoy kissing more than others.
And partially it probably depends on the lips and the tongue of your partner.
Right. And some people enjoy breast play more than others. Some women, their breasts and their nipples are not very sensitive. Other women are. So if you go into sex assuming that everybody's, you know, breasts are very sensitive, that may or may not be the case.
Or not sensitive and you think you can bite them or something.
Right. And especially as a woman goes through a breastfeeding phase, I mean, her attitude about her breasts and all that it's going to shift and it's going to change. So the advice to men out there is, and for all you listening with your spouse, this is what you're supposed to be doing, is the breast may or may not do anything for her, and they may or not do anything for him, but you need to communicate about that. Some women's nipples are not very sensitive, so they might like firmer sort of nipple play.
Or they might not care about it at all, but they might enjoy the fact that you enjoy playing.
Right. It's just another form of touch and all that sort of stuff. So, but it's something you need to communicate about, and the ladies need to tell, saying, I like it when you touch me here. When you touch me here, it doesn't do much good.
Men can't read your minds.
Right. As a lot, while we're on touch, I think one thing I read a few years ago that was good advice is women tend to touch softly and men tend to touch harder. And that's a good thing to know. You should touch the other person the way they sort of touch. Oh. So men, you should probably touch your females in a softer way than you're used to touching. And females, you should probably touch your man harder than you're used to or you think you should touch. And that goes for the entire body. Let's talk about the vagina. More appropriate, let's talk about the vulva.
The vulva is the whole thing except for the booty, right?
Except for the... Yeah, yeah. So going from 12 o'clock down to 6 o'clock.
Well, first you've got the pubis.
Yeah, so the area right above, and if you push on your partner right there, you'll feel the bone. It's not very deep.
And a lot of times it's sort of sticks up a little bit.
Right. There's a bit of a mound there. Mm-hmm. And then you have the labia major on either side, which are sort of fatty
lips.
Yeah, they're not as lippy. They're more signaling with my hands.
I don't that's probably the closest thing, maybe earlobe, maybe, but it's got a little bit of kind of a moist side to it.
Yeah, because
that's why it's more like a lip.
It goes into the center of the vagina. It's probably for a lot of women more sensitive than other parts of their body, but it's definitely not like super sexually and same with the inner thighs. For a lot of people, both men and women find the inner thigh to be more
arousing.
Yeah, it's more sensitive.
Mm-hmm. But not like super, super sensitive.
Okay, so coming down from the top, coming between those two lips, you'll hit the clitoral hood,
and it's like a
it's, you know, you're looking in the folds, and if a woman spreads her legs open, then the vagina will or the vulva will open up, and I'm sure we're gonna get all sort of hate mail from all sort of women are saying we're saying all this stuff wrong. But
well,
one thing that's interesting about human beings is there's a huge variety of differences in their genitalia, like more so than in their faces in terms of color and structure. Like going from the top of the vagina to the clitoral hood to the point you reach the clitoris can be inches on some women and very short on others. So for some women, from the top of their vagina, those labia major, to the bottom.
You mean vulva.
Can be very long, several inches. In some women, it's very short. So it can be a different size, the whole thing.
And so there's like a little flap of skin. That's the clitoral hood. And what is the clitoral part?
So it comes down.
It's the special little button of skin that is hidden by the clitoral
and
hood.
And once again, there could be a wide variety of size, just like with men and their
Right,
their
I
penis.
Say little button, but you know, there are large
There are
clitters
large
clitoris,
and there are little tiny ones. And some of them will stay almost completely hidden underneath the clitoral hood. And just like a man, now when we were babies in utero, that you start out with the same genitalia, basically the pieces, you know. And for boys, the eggs drop and become the testicles. For women, they stay up and are the
ovaries.
So everything is sort of everything on a man has an analogous part on a woman. So the clitoris is basically the same thing as the penis.
It's sort of the head of the penis.
Right. And it does go deep inside, and it kind of flattens out in the body and goes up over the top of the vaginal canal underneath the pubis. And so for a lot of people, when they talk about simulating the G-spot, what some theorize, what you're basically doing is stimulating the inside of that clitoris.
Kind of the back of it.
Right. The clitoris is the ground zero for sexual activity. Below the clitoris is the urethra.
And it's just a little teeny
hole.
Hole. Well, and, that's where the pee comes out.
And then below that is the vaginal opening. Surrounding the vaginal opening inside your
larger lips.
Your labial major are the labia, which
minor,
which tend to be colored, like some women they're very dark, almost a brownish. It's the same thing goes for men's testicles, their scrotum, and for some women they're pink, but they tend to become darker in color as they get engorged with blood. So when a woman becomes sexually aroused, the clitoris will expand, will grow a little bit like the penis does. And the labia will tend to become engorged with blood. As a matter of fact, I think the whole vulva does to some extent. And the vagina, the vaginal canal, actually extends.
And the labia minora, they are sort of a thin skin. If you're a male and you took the scrotum skin and just kind of like folded it over, so it's just like two layers of skin.
Uh huh.
Like one on one side, one on the other, is be sort of like that.
And this is a thing you can read a lot about, but I blame the censors. Let's go back in time. If you have an R-rated or X-rated film, like a not a triple X, like full movie, but like cable porn or hotel porn, the censors decided that if you could see any labia, then it was the genitals were in a state of arousal, and they couldn't show that. So, like, if you watch a movie, you can see a penis in an R-rated movie, but you can't see an erect penis in an R-rated movie. And the same thing, you can see a vulva in an R-rated movie, but you can't see any labia. So what they did is they selected actresses who didn't have large labia. And what it has done is it's induced this whole sort of, some people would say, an epidemic of people getting plastic surgery on their vaginas to get a labioplasty, to remove those labial lips, because they've seen in the movies that everybody has this cute little vulva that doesn't have the lips. But it is completely normal to have very large labial lips that sort of hang down.
And a lot of people would say that that's one of the things you can look for sexual maturity, as opposed to like a child's.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So,
but not all women have naturally large labia.
No. There's a huge
and some
variety.
Women have very large. Mm-hmm.
And that's all normal.
Right. There's a range.
There's nothing wrong with any of that,
unless it's uncomfortable for you, which it can be if they're long and they're getting pulled in and out during intercourse or something like that. That can hurt.
Right. And for that, every man or whoever's going down there should know that until that you reach that state of arousal, even for the labial lips, they can be dry, and that can be the woman needs to be adequately aroused and lubricated. Otherwise, sex can be painful, even for a woman who's had sex a lot. And I'm not
and
just
even
talking about
for a woman who has good natural lubrication, it's often the case that, like, right at the opening, there's not a lot of lubrication. And if you're a circumcised male, which we'll get into shortly, you're likely to not have much moisture on the head of your penis. So it helps to have lubrication when you enter.
And there's people out there who will argue, and mostly pharmaceutical companies, that not having enough lubrication is a sexual disorder. It's not. It's very, very normal. So if she is dry or sex is dry, it's everybody should get, I don't care how young they are, whatever, they should have lubrication there, because you're going to make sex more pleasant and just less painful for the female. The female will naturally lubricate, but you don't have to rely on that, nor necessarily should you. Like Zilpha said, even if the female's lubricating, it may not be lubricated on the front where
right
you're going to make
outside,
first contact. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit more about the clitoris. So the clitoris is generally how women orgasm. And I think you looked up our statistics on vaginal or orgasm.
Yeah, well, the statistic I found, it was just a really quick search, but I mean, I've heard it similar figures before, was that 75% of women have never been able to orgasm through intercourse. Never, ever.
And I would say that number is low, because I think the women who can orgasm through intercourse are doing so by rubbing their clitoris against the pelvis of their partner. Or, in other words, their anatomy, which we said was variable, is in such a manner that their clitoris gets stimulated during intercourse.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the nerve endings in the vagina are on the outside and in the first little surface area. There's not tons inside. So if you can orgasm completely through vaginal stimulation,
you're weird.
You're strange. And the reason I say that is because a lot of women, especially, let's go back to the beginning of the podcast, come out of this being taught that
intercourse only.
Intercourse is sex. Other forms of sodomy are wrong. And that sex should be the sacred and special
majestic
and experience. And most women are up for huge disappointment. I'm afraid most of the people in the church, for women, until they go out and get some information, are going to be hugely disappointed by intercourse in and of itself.
Absolutely.
Especially if, I mean, to me, it's a horrific thing that if he's not touching or kissing or licking or doing something to prepare her beforehand, because even if he lubes
up,
she's not going to be ready if he just is, and she is not going to enjoy the experience. Now, maybe after she's had a couple of babies, it won't bother her anymore. But but I mean, it's still horrific. You have to. Now, if you go and make out for a long time, it might be that you get aroused enough. But
yeah, but most busy parents wouldn't have that kind of time. So anyway. It is necessary to directly stimulate the clitoris for most women.
Okay.
Most.
So let's talk about how that's
majority.
Done.
This is the fun part.
You can't go for broke from the get-go. The clitoris is particularly sensitive.
It's kind of like the head of your penis, just like right under the urethral opening.
On the front side.
So it's very sensitive.
So you can imagine somebody grabbed, fellas, you can imagine somebody grabbed your penis and started rubbing the bottom of it really hard, really fast. You'd be like, whoa, 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 wait, slow down. And that's the way. So if you're going to either manually, you know, with your fingers or with your tongue, you need to start in without a lot of pressure and more slowly. And then what you need to do is you need to slowly increase the intensity of your action. Some women can be manually stimulated. Some women cannot. There are a huge number of women that no matter how much you lick, suck, kiss, whatever down there, they're never going to orgasm. They probably need a vibrator. They need stronger stimulation.
Yes.
But it's different for every woman. And you're just going to have to learn what your woman's thing.
And that's where communication comes in.
This is where communication comes in.
And it's hard as a woman to say, that doesn't really.
Slower, that's not working.
Yeah. Or I prefer it if you don't use your finger. Or I prefer it if you don't push that hard with your tongue, or just you have to say, because he can't read your mind.
Right.
And also another thing,
go ahead,
that we sort of have figured out recently, which has been a really nice thing to figure out, is
you're talking about G-spot.
Yeah.
Well, let's hold that for a second. So we need to finish the.
Oh,
so
I didn't. I thought we were done with the.
No. If you don't know what to do, fellas or whoever's down there, I'm you know, anything, whatever. Go. Start with the alphabet. So take your tongue and do A, B, C, D, E, F, and just spell out the alphabet on the clitoris. That's a good way to start.
Or just go back and forth, back and forth.
Up and down.
You can either go back and forth or up and down. They both feel good.
And so...
Or for, you know, generally, for most women, I would think.
As she reacts more, you want to increase the intensity, increase the pressure and the speed.
And you have to have like a motorboat tongue.
But this is so important for you ladies. You have to be communicative. And if you don't want to use words, this is a good conversation to have when you're not in it. Because I know when everybody's performing, it's sort of hard. And maybe you just push back on his head a little bit.
If it's too hard.
Or pull him in a little bit if you want.
But you can hold on to his ears. That's your handlebars.
Because I mean, frankly, the clitoris is too small for a man's tongue or fingers to be able to tell if she's responding. Now, if he's tuned in, she might start, you know, responding more. She might start breathing harder or bucking a little bit.
Well,
or
it
whatever.
Probably depends on the female how small that is, but I think for some,
even then, your tongue is still not a hugely sensitive organ that way.
Right. What, yeah, saying, it might be hard to.
I'm just trying to underline the communication thing.
Right. Very important.
Okay, so the G-spot. The G-spot, if you take and put your finger in, insert your finger into the vagina, and you're inserting your finger with
it can be the pointer finger or the up. Or the middle finger.
And then what you want to do is there's a ridge just on the inside, and then there's a space up there. And if you feel up there, you'll feel a rough spot. And it's usually somewhere around there.
Yeah, it's like a little bumps, and it's just a small little thing.
And one of the best ways to start is to very this same thing goes. You have to start light is to do just a little come here action and you can try going back and forth or,
like a windshield wiper.
And some women will have a very intense orgasm, and they will ejaculate, but a lot of women can't do that. But if they do, it's normal. It's not pee.
When he says ejaculate, it's this liquid that can squirt out of the vagina when it's a G-spot orgasm.
Right.
I think it's fairly rare. But
so oftentimes, for a lot
I've
of women,
seen it on porn.
For a lot of women, that some women can have very intense orgasms from that. Other women, it just feels good. And it took us years to get. I don't know if it's just from you getting older or learning the technique, but before it even felt good.
Yeah, because I think when you first learned about it, you were doing the come here stroke right on that rough spot, and I was like, "Ow!"
Just sort of
hurt.
Work around.
But then I decided I wanted to figure it out more, so I explored in there myself, and I found out that my sensitive spot is above the rough spot, and it needs to be like really, really gentle at first.
Now, there are some women that it needs to be very intense, and it's more of a tapping, pop, 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 pop.
And sometimes it needs two fingers
right
up there.
It can also help because, you know, I said before that some people theorize what you're doing, you're stimulating the inside, the long part of the clitoris. And sometimes it helps to either put a small amount of pressure up above the pubic bone. And to do that in conjunction with oral stimulation, oftentimes.
Yeah, that helped a lot. You know, if John was to just do the G-spot thing, it's not as good But when he adds the oral, then that's way better than either of them by themselves.
Okay. So here's something that's very important. Once again, I'm talking to you sort of people fresh out. Women, you have got to learn your own body. And what you need to do is you need to spend some time all alone with yourself, with no one watching and no pressure. And then I would advise every couple in the world to spend more time doing mutual masturbation, both where that you're stimulating each other and where you're just sitting next to each other and
watching,
doing it.
Or just being next to each other while
because you'll learn what sort of intensity, if they go back and forth or side to side, just all sorts of things that will help you learn what stimulates your partner.
And also look in the mirror. I mean, there's a lot.
I mean,
kinda,
really look in the, like sit on a mirror.
And investigate yourself, because it's sort of complicated down there, and it takes some getting used to if you've never seen it before. But you should know what you have down there. You should know what it looks like.
Right. And there are a bazillion vaginas for viewing on the internet. Spend some time and check some of them out. Porn is like anything
males
else.
Males and females
should
do that.
There's good porn and there's awful porn. But they're just in terms of just medical journals. There's plenty of where we don't live in an age where the information is all sketch drawings that you can go and find information out.
Sketch drawings are pretty much useless.
Now let's do. We've mentioned porn a couple times. This is not about porn, but everyone should know that whenever something is happening on stage, be it a Shakespearean production or a movie or pornography, that actors exaggerate. For the cameras or for the audience. That's always been the case. Porn is a form of theater. So, yes, you have to understand that people are acting over the top, and they're oftentimes using sexual positions and techniques to increase the airspace between the partners so the camera can see what's going on.
Right. When you see, like, ladies upside down on a couch or something like that, that's not necessarily a fun way to have sex. But it's just that maybe the camera can get...
My point is that people don't really confuse this. You know, it's like people say, oh, I don't want like boys watching porn because they'll get strange ideas about sex. And then they'll let them watch Pirates of the Caribbean. Where do they get strange ideas about pirates? Pirates are bad people. I mean, every movie, every form of entertainment, Shakespeare on down, the Bible, it's all this over-the-top exaggeration.
Right. And a lot of times, if you happen to see a porn movie, that even the sound, they'll like do a loop of the woman going but it doesn't match up with her mouth, and it's right. Like just the soundtrack,
right?
And it so I mean you can it is theater, like John said. It's not necessarily realistic.
And like theater, most of it's bad. Okay.
But you can see the anatomy there. And that's right. An important thing, I think, to see the variety and what kinds of things people have down there.
Because your body is your, and even if you believe in God and religion, your body is your body that God gifted to you. And there's no shame in knowing how it works. There's no shame in knowing what works during sex and what doesn't work. And there's no shame in having an orgasm, for heaven's sakes. So if you're going to have them, I mean, if you're going to have sex, you just will have the best sex you can have.
Amen, brother.
Okay. So let's talk about anything we left off on female anatomy. I mean, this is like, we're going to be a 2-hour podcast here, but I mean, there's lots of information out there, and this is just, getting wet a little bit.
Yeah, we can move on to the men.
Okay. So analogous to the vulva is the penis. The real benefit that women have is that they can always check to see if a man is
turned on.
Now, I think we even talked about this in previous podcasts. There was a study that showed they would present to college students pictures of naked men and naked women.
Of the opposite sex.
And they had an eye tracker on. And men first looked
at the eyes.
At her eyes. And women first looked at
the penis.
And there's an obvious reason.
Well, women wanted to see if that guy was sexually aroused.
You can tell if he's aroused. You can immediately tell if he's aroused. With a female, you can't tell if she's aroused.
But you might be able to tell by her facial expression.
And you might be able to tell by her eyes, because her eyes will dilate if she's sexually aroused. So, and that goes for men too. There's a tip for y'all. If you're looking at somebody and their eyes, their pupils get bigger, then they're probably, at least on some level,
attracted
to you. So the penis, right?
Yeah. And first of all, a lot of people in America are circumcised.
So
that's going down. Less people are doing that. So what circumcision is the cutting off of a chunk of skin that covers the head of the penis. It's sort of like the clitoral hood, but it's for the penis, and that gets cut off in a circumcision.
So the problem with it is that the head of the penis is very sensitive, and it secretes what is the stuff called?
It's not sebum, is it?
It's not sebum, but it's something like sebum. And actually, the female genitalia secretes that stuff too. And it doesn't stop secreting that stuff. It just gets secreted into your underpants or whatever.
It's very subtle. It's not like a huge amount.
It's very subtle. And it's just like, and the idea, some women get the strange idea about there being really, that the penis gets really gross, or I'm sure it does on some people, but that's not the way the body works. You know, if you bathe regularly, it's not going to be a problem.
Oh, you mean if you're uncircumcised?
Right.
Well, what it does do is it keeps the head of the penis moist.
And especially for children, like when a child is first born, the foreskin is actually attached to the head. It only slowly separates over time. So like,
which is good, because let's face it, if you are uncircumcised, how can you tell? I mean, what happens when you're aroused? Your head comes out. So it's like having little boys looking like they're sexually charged up.
Right. The evolutionary biologist theorized, like, it's like the lipstick. You know, the lipstick is your lips on your vulva become engorged with blood and become more red. So the reason people wear lipstick is it's a subtle, unconscious sexual signaling that means attractiveness. And they theorized that the reason people started circumcising is because then they were walking around, it's like a penis gourd. Mm-hmm. They were walking around with an erect penis all the time, basically.
It made them more, looked like it.
More sexually attractive without actually having to achieve an erection.
Right. And so some people have very sensitive tips of their penis, and when that foreskin is gone, then it rubs against their underwear, and it can cause problems.
What happens to men who are circumcised is that their head, which is sensitive, is rubbing against their pants and their underwear all the time, and it sort of dulls that sensation.
It can get sort of a callus on it.
Right.
And it's certainly not moist. So that's where the lubrication comes in again.
Right. Once again, yeah, if you're an uncircumcised or you're a circumcised male, you know,
especially,
you need to carry around your Astroglide. So the penis becomes engorged with blood and becomes erect.
And what that means is it grows and it becomes kind of hard. That was kind of a surprise to me, because after seeing those line drawings, it was a whole different thing when I saw an actual erect penis. It was bigger, and that was a compliment to you, John. it was just different than I imagined. It was bigger and scarier than I imagined, and it looked good.
Well, I mean, if you've never seen it, I mean, for both the genitalia, they're sort of strange looking.
It's almost like the back of your throat. I mean, there's stuff down there that you don't see very often, but it's kind of strange looking if you actually look down there, or inside your ear, or, you know, because there's a lot going on, for one thing. And then for another thing, we don't see it. It's
right.
Not hanging out all the time like nose.
For the roadmap of sensitivity, the shaft of the penis is more sensitive. It has more nerve endings, but the head of the penis is the most sensitive. And a lot of men don't even like to be touched on the head of their penis directly.
Especially the very tip.
The very tip.
Like where the urethra is.
And then the bottom, the most sensitive part is like a couple millimeters down from the tip on the bottom. And once a man becomes aroused, if you focus on that area, and especially if you're giving oral sex to a man and then you touch or lick or whatever that, and then get off, and then, but the main trick to oral sex with a man is just don't stay in any one place too long. And no teeth.
No teeth. But, and also, it helps to use your hand at the same time. So if it's hard to go, you know, in and out with your head bobbing up and down, you can use your hand to do the up and down because the shaft likes to be moved. The skin on the shaft, it feels good if that's moved up and down. So you can use a soft, warm, moist mouth around the head and the top of the penis while you're rubbing with your hand, usually with some moisture or some lubricant, because that feels good. So it doesn't rub the skin too much. And just rub up and down and lick. And you don't want to suck too hard. And you certainly don't want to blow, even though it's called that. That's not what you do. I mean, every man's different, just like every woman's different. So the guy's got to tell you what he likes and what he doesn't like.
And that goes for like the scrotum. The scrotum can be sensitive too.
And sometimes it's good to, while you're doing the oral stimulation and rubbing up and down on the shaft, you can use your other hand to kind of cup the scrotum, and that feels kind of good. And you can like gently rub the skin, like right under the scrotum. There's this, this spot between the scrotum and the anus that sometimes,
for both male and female, some people find that place to be. And of
and
course,
you can lick the scrotum.
Even
don't
down
be afraid
to the,
of those hairy balls.
Even down to the anus. I mean, we're not getting into a varsity level sex here, but that's why people like to play down there because it can be very sensitive.
Right. So, some people really like anal play.
So you just it's just a matter of communication. Once again, this is where,
and sometimes you have to try things out and see if you like it.
And you have to try them out at least 3 times, right?
Right.
Because you might not be doing it right. That's the only thing, you know. But
and maybe you have to kind of relax into it.
Yeah, yeah. And it's not uncommon, especially when you first get with a partner, that men have a hard time achieving an erection. There's we have this cultural idea that men are just all about conquest and stuff, but there's a lot of information that shows that men actually pair bond sometimes more intensely than women do.
That they're more hurt psychologically if the partnership breaks up, and that they are more less likely to be able to achieve an erection with a new partner than they are with an established partner.
Right. So pressures that way can interfere with a man's ability to achieve an erection. And the ability to achieve an erection is not fully consciously controlled. So a man does not have direct control over that. When they're younger and a lot hornier, they can do it more readily. But my point I want to get to is that a man can be fully aroused and into his partner and still not able to achieve an erection.
And the more he stresses about it, the less likely he would be able
once
to.
You're down that path, you're sunk.
It's almost like a female trying to have an orgasm. Sometimes if you try too hard and stress about it, it's just not going to happen. You sort of have to relax.
How did we not talk about vibrators?
You mentioned it, but vibrators for women are usually a really good thing.
Everybody should have one. Now,
some women don't like it because it sort of makes you a little bit itchy. You know, if
the vibration is intense, I would suggest everybody get like an egg sort of one, a small compact vibrator that doesn't have strong. And then they get the Hitachi magic wand.
Oh.
Because that and she needs to spend some alone time with it without him watching
her.
Yes,
definitely.
Or whatever to learn what works and what doesn't work. Because the way females work, and this is you to a T, Zilpha, is oftentimes sex is not as interesting until you get turned. So a man gets turned on before sex, and usually a woman gets turned on during sex.
Right. So sometimes John will hand me the magic wand and say, well, you know, I can be, yeah, I'm interested in having sex, but I'm not really turned on. So I'll warm up with the wand.
And
also during intercourse, since I'm not one of those ladies who can orgasm through intercourse, I use a little vibrator. It's like the size of half of my pinky, and it's got like a soft gel kind of cover on it, or like silicone or something like that. So it's so it's soft and it's got a little cushion to it. So I can just stick it right on my clitoris during intercourse and I can orgasm during intercourse, which is really nice.
Yes. So that's one of those unrealistic, you know, the idea that if I really love somebody, I should be able to orgasm with them every time, or that I won't need extra aids. I won't need lubricant. I won't need, vibrators.
Those are unrealistic expectations.
Which is the next thing on the list, unrealistic expectations. The number one thing, and I've harped on this before, is sex is a lot of things. It's mostly fun. It feels good, but it doesn't always feel the same amount of good.
And right. Sometimes it can be a mind-blowing experience, and so, it can be just like, oh my gosh, that was the most amazing feeling ever. But most of the time it's like, ah, that was nice.
Right.
And once in a while it's like, ooh, well, that was okay, I guess.
But that's all right. Is what I'm saying is the biggest bullshit the church puts out about sex is when they keep talking about it being sacred or like this holy experience. Sometimes it's dirty, sometimes it's messy.
It's always messy. Come on.
Sometimes it's more messy than others. But sometimes it's erotic. Sometimes it's just intimate. Sometimes it's like a big snuggle. Sometimes it's really hot. And it depends. And if you're always wanting to achieve a certain type of experience, like you always want to feel closer to your partner, you're going to be disappointed, you know?
Right. It's not every time going to be some huge emotionally bonding experience.
Right. And it doesn't always have to be. One thing that's fun about sex is it's one of those things where you are both doing something for yourself. It's a selfish act and a giving act at the same time.
And it feels good to them.
And if you're always selfless in sex, you're going to be disappointed. And if you're always selfish in sex, you're going to be disappointed. So I think it's a great microcosm of the universe because things tend to work out best when we have a certain amount of self-interest mixed with philanthropy. Mm-hmm. And that's what sex is all about. But what I'm saying here is that the biggest thing is everyone needs to lower their expectations.
And then you'll be pleasantly surprised.
Our bodies change over time, too. So what worked when we were 22 may not work when we're 32, may not work when we're 42.
And especially when you've got young kids, we've talked about this before, when you've got kids hanging all over you all day long, it's okay. It's okay to not want to be close to one more person that day. And it's hard for the spouse who's not had the kids clinging on them all day to understand because they still need that kind of connection. But so those are things that you need to communicate about and work through.
And I think this is a hugely important point. I know it was hard for me until I figured it out. And I've talked to other friends. It's been hard for, especially with those toddler years and you didn't breastfeed because we adopted our children, but
still they were on me all the time.
Right. But for a lot of women, they just sort of lose their sexual drive.
And the breasts become their child's for those years.
Right.
And they don't really like mixing the genres.
No, some people do. And that's the thing about sex. Nothing is universal. You know, there's always somebody who hates something and there's somebody who's fetishized.
Right. Like sometimes it's even better. Like their breasts are funner when they're breastfeeding.
Right. And there's people who in the late terms of their pregnancy get really super horny and there's people who have the opposite problem. But this is where things like, this is why we evolved the ability or God gave us the ability to masturbate, you know, because there's a certain amount of sexual tension that can build up in an individual. And
we forgot to talk about ejaculation.
What do you want to talk about ejaculation?
Well, because you said it was messy. And before I got married, everybody, my mom sat me down and had a little talk with me about sex so that I wouldn't be surprised, which was really nice. But she said it was messy. She didn't quite go into why it was messy. So I found out that when a male orgasms, they squirt out like this milky fluid. And it's about like maybe a teaspoon to a tablespoon worth.
Yeah.
And it just squirts out where their pee normally comes out. And it has to go somewhere. So, you know, if you're not using protection, like a condom. It'll go, if you're having intercourse, it'll go in your vagina and then it'll kind of drip out.
But also the vaginal secretion itself, some women output a lot of, so that's completely normal. If you soak a towel when you're having sex, that's normal. That's not, it's not like everyone does that, but that is completely healthy and normal.
And especially like oral sex, where he's kind of slobbering all over and you're juicing it up.
And some guys put out a lot of pre-ejaculate too.
Oh yeah. So they drip.
I mean, a lot.
They drip out this clear fluid when they're really aroused before the ejaculation comes. And it's kind of like snot, but it's nice.
All right. So,
anyway, that's the messy
yeah,
stuff.
So unrealistic expectations again is that, yeah. In the movies, they always have sex and then like go to bed snuggling. Yeah. In real life, most people get up and go pee.
Yeah. Well, and it's healthy for a female, especially to go pee right after intercourse, because it'd be less likely to get, an infection, a urinary tract infection.
Correct.
But I used to think, you know, when I was a teenager, I used to think, yeah, we'll have sex and then we'll just, we'll just stay in that position all night. Right. Well, what happens after the guy orgasms is his penis starts to shrink. And when it's not erect, it is not going to stay in your vagina.
So when both male and females ejaculate, or they orgasm, I should say, there is a release of
endorphins.
Yes.
Serotonin.
Whatever it is,
I think it's endorphins.
It's basically very similar to sort of kind of getting high with marijuana. You immediately,
or even eating a really really tasty
food,
you immediately
mellow out. And this is why some people won't like masturbate before like they have to do some sort of sporting event, because it will sort of, it has a mellowing effect. That's why you hear about like makeup sex sort of thing, because there's that intensity, then there's that mellowing effect. So well, not only does an orgasm itself feel good, but the after effect of sex can, and that's why people feel
sleepy.
Isn't
that called afterglow?
Yeah.
Yay, afterglow.
But let's see, what else well, am I going to say?
I was going to mention that before that relaxation comes, there's an increasing amount of tension. And the tension builds and builds and builds. And it feels really good, but there is this tension. And then when the orgasm comes, it releases.
Right.
And it just melts.
So when we talk about realistic expectation, we'll talk about getting better at sex. But so the other thing that people have to understand, especially for males, will immediately have a chemical event in their body, and they'll lose their interest in sex completely. Now, and that effect gets worse at the older they get. So then they'll have a male will have what's called the refractory period, where after they orgasm a few minutes later, they'll lose their erection and they will be unable to achieve one again for a certain amount of time. And that's mixed with a complete and utter drop in interest in sex. They just lose. It's every woman should feel that thing to be, you know, just completely obsessed with sex and then immediately have it all go away. Cause it's a fascinating thing. So the older a man gets, you know, you might've been when you were together, when you were 20, that, you know, he could
have orgasm.
You could have a 4-hour lovemaking session. He would orgasm 4 times. It becomes, for most men, it becomes physiologically more impossible as time goes on. So really,
but females can do multiple orgasms.
Right.
And it's more likely for them than for males.
Yes. But that's probably on our varsity level. Well,
varsity.
So as you get better at sex, it's a physical activity. So exercise, eating healthy, all that sort of stuff will help. And
you'll feel better and you'll have more energy and you'll also look better,
be more attractive to your partner. Yeah. But it's a skill, and you just have to learn, you know, like the men have to, for a lot of men, they have to learn to hold off and come at the right moment. I'm trying not to use dirty words, so I just break my, when I said orgasm at the right moment. Sometimes the female has to learn to in fact orgasm. It might take her a lot of concentration to get to that point where she can orgasm. And it's just a skill set that can be developed over time. You can get better at it over time.
Well, especially when you're with the same partner for a long time, you sort of can read each other's emotions and mood.
So when we're talking about realistic and unrealistic expectations, let's talk about thought crimes, because it's another thing that I think really ties LDS people up. There are no thought crimes, and there especially are no thought crimes during sex. No one has any right to ask or know what's going through their partner's head when they're having sex. Now, it might be that you and your partner really enjoy sharing that thing, and I would suggest that sort of activity. But if you're going to go into that sort of activity, you have to be non-judgmental. We are, to go back to the beginning of the podcast, sexual beings, and you are going to have all sorts of things going through your head, some of them that are things you would never want to do in real life.
It's almost like a dream, except you're awake.
And you are going to think about people.
That doesn't mean that you're necessarily in control. I mean, although I think you can kind of guide your thoughts, but sometimes for a female, especially, simple like back and forth motion on your clitoris might not be enough. You might need to use some emotional stimulation.
Yes.
So you can create that stimulation yourself in your mind by going through scenarios and having fantasies. And that might be the only way that you're going to be able to achieve an orgasm.
Absolutely. And what I'm getting at is, you know, a lot of people feel a lot of guilt about touching themselves or whatever. And part of it is because of what goes through their head. And I think a lot of women, especially, and men also, feel a lot of guilt because they're basically committing adultery and all sorts of unspeakable acts in their mind while they're supposed to be having this spiritual experience with their spouse. I'm saying that's normal, that's healthy, and that's okay. And there are things that your body's going to come up with when you're in there that you would never even want to do in real life, and the best thing to do is just in a zen sort of way, just watch them go.
Say, wow, that was titillating for 2 seconds, and say goodbye to it.
But especially when it comes to, now, you know, if you find that you're thinking or obsessing about some sort of criminal act all the time, even when you're not in coitus,
you might want to talk to
a counselor. But even if and I'll recommend some books here, especially for females tend to have a lot wider variety of just all sorts of weird stuff that goes through their mind during sex.
Yeah.
And that's normal, and that's healthy, and that's okay. And well, you know, once again, you might have like your husband's friend who that you don't like. You think he's a big bore. You're not sexually attracted to him at all. But damn it, every time you have sex, you have fantasy about this guy. Even though
you don't think about him at any other time. But it's like, for some reason, that psychologically turns you on. And that's okay.
That's okay. And that's healthy. And if you get bent out of shape by the fact that your partner is fantasizing about having sex with your sister or with your friends, I got news for you, honey. There's no way to get around that. You know, it's just sort of... it just sort of comes with the program. You know what I mean? And I think you're going to tie yourself in knots if you're trying to control your thoughts. Now, you can find things that sort of feed your spank bank a little bit, you know, so things that are going to like get you off more than others.
Well, and pornography is sometimes a good way to feed your fantasy banks. I mean, I've worked through porn scenarios in my fantasies. They've been very useful.
And the reason this is helpful is because, once again, we're not necessarily wired to have sex with one person every 3 days for the rest of our lives. So having some other material to draw on where you can still love the person, but somehow
and still be faithful
your
to
erotic
them.
Imagination is let loose a little bit more.
Yeah. Right. It almost allows you to be what is the word? When you're singly and you don't step out.
On?
No, you don't step out.
Faithful?
It allows you to be, yeah, in that kind of...
fidelity?
Maybe. It allows you to be fidelidicious.
All right. So the last thing I have on the list here is communication. I mean, we've mentioned over and over again, it's all about talking about this stuff. And
the first time
the first
that you...
20 times.
Try it, it's going to be... a little uncomfortable, and you're going to maybe feel a little jealous or whatever if, say, your partner tells you a fantasy that you ask to hear. But that's part of kind of getting used to getting to letting yourself and letting them be sexual beings.
There are things that either man or woman that person can tell you that will sort of flip your lid a little bit, right? So what I'm saying is you might not want to start out with the, hey, let's share our wackiest fantasy.
Start out with communicating about what feels good during sex.
Right. But I mean, I think it's good for a couple to reach the point where they can talk about all this stuff. And even in a very communicative couple, they can't talk about everything all the time. That's why I say there's some things that you only want to talk about when you're hot. There's some things you only want to talk about when you're cold.
Yes.
And you sort of have to realize that you're not perfect. I mean, I think this goes to other aspects of your life. If you go in saying, I'm not the perfect lover, I can improve myself. So you're looking for ways to get that from your partner. But that goes with you just need to experiment, because if you're both married, young and very inexperienced, it's not like you could bring a lot of stuff to the table. That's why erotic literature, academic literature, pornography, all sort of things can give you ideas on how to improve your love life. And what you're going to do is you're going to improve that bond and that enjoyment that you have with your partner.
And communication in general. I mean, if you can communicate about sex, you're probably going to be able to communicate about just about everything.
Yes, I agree. Recommended books to read. The ones I've mentioned so far, there's several I've thought about as we've been talking. Desmond Morris's The Naked Ape. It's dated. There's probably better books now. Maybe somebody will recommend one. But it really talks about that evolutionary biology and that sexuality as to why we are the way we are. I think that's a really great book to start getting a hold on that. Another book that really talks a lot about the evolution of sexuality, and we talked about the standard model. These guys actually reject the standard model and suggest that we were all very polyamorous when we were back on the savannah, and we were not monogamous, and we had a lot of sex all the time. And that is
Sex at Dawn
is a book that was released last year. And it doesn't necessarily argue for to go out there and all become swingers or anything, but it will help understand that our sort of model of complete fidelity monogamy, where you don't think about or have desires for other people, is really sort of ridiculous. And we're really not wired the way. And we've sort of come at this whole discussion from that perspective of supplementing, you know, with silicone and plastic and lubricant and pornography and whatever else you as a couple can handle.
And sex at dawn would mean the beginning of humankind.
Yeah, it talks about really the evolution of sex and what sort of fragments are there. Another book that's really approachable and really readable is Mary Roach's Bonk, where she talks about kind of what's going on in terms of sex research at the time. And it really shows how little we know about sex and how we're really sort of tied up about it.
That's almost the whole point of the book is, look how little research we actually have done about sexuality.
Another book for both men and women is the book Why Women Have Sex. I don't remember the author, but they go through and they did a survey on women to really sort of understand what's... Because women's motivation for sex sort of is really complicated, and that goes with our evolutionary sort of guts, because for a woman, she's really invested in children in a real physical sort of dangerous way, and sex can always lead, you know, before the advent of any sort of birth control, sex always had the possibility of that. So to understand better female sexuality there, I think is important. Another great book to read, this one's also a little dated, by Nancy Friday, My Secret Garden, and what was her follow-up to My Secret Garden? Anyway, she wrote several of these.
I've not read that one.
Nancy Friday really explored female sexual fantasy. Oh.
I remember you reading it, and you told me all the juicy details.
Actually, I think I read it on my mission, but... Shh, don't tell anybody that. I'm sure I've told you all the juicy details.
Wasn't it the one where It talked about women were more likely to go...
Oh, Women on Top is the second book.
Oh, maybe that was it.
My Secret Garden and Women on Top. And what she really talks about is sort of what turns women on in terms of fantasy and that sort of stuff. And gets to the point that women's sexuality is both broader and more complicated than male sexuality in a lot of ways. We really focus negatively on male sexuality, especially because males tend to fetishize things. Fetish is, of course, when you become sexually fixated on an object as opposed to a person, like shoes. And if you have a true fetish, you have you have to think about those shoes in order to achieve orgasm. So that there's people who like, you know, shoes or whatever, garter belts or whatever, but a true fetish is a psychological disorder. But women's fantasy and what sort of turns them on can really be understood in these books.
How to Get the Sex You Want.
How to Get the Sex You Want. That's an okay book. Another one, the last book I read.
You bought that when I wasn't wanting very much sex.
Yeah, I was trying to get the sex that I wanted. Another really great book that came out last year is a Billion Wicked Thoughts.
The internet.
What they did in this book is they did research. You know, the problem with sex surveys is people lie through their teeth whenever it comes to sex. So what they did is they got the results from search engines, not Google, but some others, and they had like a billions and billions of returns. They really did analysis of what men versus women are looking at. I mean, what they really are searching for on the internet when it comes to sex. And they did them in terms of strengths. They would create clouds, these logical clouds of people who search for this sort of thing also search for this sort of thing to try to get at the psychology. Anyway, it goes through that research and other supporting research. It's a fascinating book that gets to the bottom of human desire and some of that sort of stuff.
And there's probably some other good books out there that if you've come across any, you can post it on the comments board or...
Right. But I mean, the point is, you know, to get out there and read and open your mind. Sex is a very important part of for most of us. For some people, it's not. For most of us, it's a very important part of our lives, and it's a very rewarding. And
it can be,
but it can be. It's just one of those things that unfortunately the church really screws up. So for all of you people who are sort of coming out of the church, you need to. You're behind the curve. And you sort of need to go and educate yourself on this thing and become a more healthy, more whole, complete human being on this front.
Right. If you're like me, you've purposefully made yourself naive about sex. Like if you would turn your head away and you wouldn't, like even those line drawings that I saw, you know, in junior high, I did not want to look at them closely. I didn't want to know. So anyway, if you're like me, it's okay. Go find out and explore.
Yeah, definitely. Well, if you've made it this far, I congratulate you.
What? This is probably the most fascinating one ever.
For us, I think for a lot of people, this will be very hard to listen to. But I know that it's hard for especially younger couples and naive couples sexually to even approach the tough. It's tough to get your spouse. I mean, there's going to be a lot of people listening to say, I wish I could get my spouse to listen to it. And maybe you should make them listen to it. Say, I really, to help understand me, I really need you to listen to this. And then we need to talk about it. Cause I think it's extremely important. And, you know, maybe my last word is our society has really undervalued sex, the importance of sex to people's psychology and how having sexual dysfunction in a marriage can be devastating psychologically to people. We try to poo-poo it. Oh, well, he didn't think he was getting enough sex from her, and then he had an affair and he left her. Well, that is completely not justifiable, but understandable when you understand our biology and what makes us tick a little bit more. And it helps you understand how serious it is. I think this is a tendency in the church for people to punish each other by withholding sex. We hear about this all the time from couples where almost every couple that we've talked to who are one inside the church, one outside the church where they're struggling, it's gone sexless. Mm-hmm. They've stopped. That one of them has withheld that intimacy. And that can be psychologically damaging on a high level. So it's very important that everybody get this one straightened out.
If they can.
If they can, yeah. They can.
There could be a lot of other underlying issues that make it unsolvable, but anyway.
Well, and I think the best thing when you set out on the journey of sexual exploration and trying to achieve a higher level of maturity when it comes to sex is acknowledge right up front saying, we know we might hurt each other or there might be things that we hear, but we agree right now that we're going to work through those issues. You know, so if we start, you know, if she's, for example, it might be that she's faked orgasms and she says, if she tells him that, that is going to sting, that is going to hurt. But you kind of have to say, we're going to work through those painful things. And if it really is that she, you know, that you have to spend an extra 45 minutes down there to get an orgasm.
Or buy her a vibrator.
Or buy her a vibrator, do whatever it takes. Or you're going to hear some things. You're going to hear that she's attracted to your friend Larry. And she's seriously attracted to him. That you say, that's fine. I understand people can be attracted. I'm going to feel a little jealous, but in a Buddhist sort of way, I'm going to watch the jealousy go by. I know that we have a loving relationship, and by working through and talking through these issues and acknowledging them, that we're going to become more healthy and we're going to be able to work through those. And those are the kind of decisions you have to make up front, saying, because the fact that she was attracted to Larry was already there.
Right.
You're just digging it out. It's not like this is something new.
Right. It's another layer of naivety. If you don't want to know, you won't know, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't exist.
Right. You can't make things not exist by hoping they weren't there.
Yep.
All right, Zilpha.
Okay. Well, that was fun. We can go have some more fun.
I think it's too late. All right.
Good night, everybody.
As always, the discussion continues on our website at MormonExpression.com. And good night.
Good night.